to Soundboard, the Steinway & Sons podcast on artistry and craftsmanship. I'm your producer and host, Ben Finan, Director of Content at Steinway. If you enjoy Soundboard, please rate, review, and subscribe to it wherever you pod your casts. Today is the birthday of Steinway immortal Duke Ellington, and my guest today is Duke's granddaughter, Mercedes Ellington. She is a choreographer and dancer, as well as the founder, CEO, and artistic director of the Duke Ellington Center for the Arts in New York City. I'd like to speak about Edward Kennedy Ellington, whom you knew as Uncle Edward, and I know him as Duke.
Yes.
So why don't we start there?
Okay. Well, I asked my father when I came to know that side of my family, and my grandmother, my mother's mother, she raised me. So she sometimes would drop me off at the Apollo when my grandfather was playing there, and I would be in the capable hands of the wives of the musicians. And they would sit with me in the audience, and I was in heaven because I would watch the movie and then see the show and a movie and a show and a movie and a show. And that was really great. And as I came to know that side of my family better, I was more in tune with my father. I asked him, I said, well, what should I call my grandfather? Because he was very sensitive about age. He didn't even want his own son to call him Pops, you know, but which my father did just in spite. My father suggested that I ask him, my grandfather, what I should call him. And he came up with the name Uncle Edward. So from then on, I called him Uncle Edward, and some close members of his family and friends also called him Uncle Edward. And I must add, he called me Aunt Mercedes.
So Mercedes, for me, Duke Ellington was a real bridge builder. When I think of a musician who went from Take the A Train all the way through to Money Jungle, which was really the entire history of jazz, that shows me that he was, in a way, immune to any sort of generational divide. I wonder if you saw that musical evolution, how he was able to roll with the times.
Well, I can only refer to his description of Ella Fitzgerald, which he called her beyond category. He considered jazz the folk music of America, and he described Ella Fitzgerald as beyond category because there was nothing that she could not sing. And he never wanted to be restricted to a specific place, time, type of music, anything, because he wanted anything and everything to be open so that he could be free to explore. And essentially, that's what he did. If you look at his entire catalog, it ranges from operas to short suites like The River and to popular songs and everything. So he really did want to be free. And his advice, for instance, his advice to Tony Bennett was that everyone should do at least two things. So he encouraged Tony Bennett to pursue his artistic endeavors and to paint, because he also painted. He didn't paint a lot because I don't think he was in one place long enough to even set up an easel, but he did do a few things. I have a scarf, for instance, that he painted the word Evie because of his lady friend, who was a dancer at the Cotton Club, and his companion. She was one of the people that he really always came back to, and so he painted her name on a scarf.
The Duke and Ella. So let's have a wonderful.
Don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Do-a-do-a-do-a-do-a-do-a-do-a-do-a. It don't mean a thing. All you gotta do is sing. Do-a-do-a-do-a-do-a-do-a-do-a-do-a. Makes no difference if it's sweet.
Don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Don't mean a thing on you.
I know that Tony Bennett wrote the introduction to your book on Duke Ellington. He said, "Duke Ellington was and will remain America's foremost classical composer. The breadth and depth of his work is comparable to the work of Beethoven, Bach, or Mozart, and 500 years from now, his music will be revered just as much as it is now."
Yes.
So I think Mr. Bennett was echoing what you were saying about people, artists, music that is beyond category. While we don't maybe think of Duke as a classical composer, it's interesting to think of him composing American classical music, is how I would put it.
Yes, exactly. We went to Russia. I went to Russia with them because I had always wanted to be a ballerina. So when I found out they were going to Russia on a State Department tour, I said, "You are not going without me." I took 2 weeks off of the show that I was doing on Broadway called No, No, Nanette. And I went with them. And one of his hopes was that he could find Tchaikovsky's original score so that he could complete and do the first act of his version, his and Billy's version of the Nutcracker. And they kept us so busy, I don't think he ever found it.
You said something in this same book that Duke carried a Bible and a thesaurus everywhere he went.
Yeah.
Why did he carry those two books?
The Bible, because he always wanted inspiration from the divine. And he firmly believed that he was motivated by his belief, his religious beliefs. He was always communicating with other people so that they knew that that was the basis of his inspiration. The thesaurus, he was always writing things on his shirt sleeves and on napkins and things, and he would play with words. And I think he just wanted to, he got certain inspiration from those words. And so maybe from a phrase or something that he would put together that would kick him off into the direction of an entire song or an entire piece of music, because he not only wrote the songs, I think he was a frustrated playwright, because Queenie Pie was like that. When we did Sophisticated Ladies, that was supposed to be a tribute, and the story of the orchestra, that was the beginning. John Gare was supposed to be writing about the experiences of the orchestra in the very beginning. But things got so contorted and so busy, and we had so much music, the words got cut out eventually. And so it became a review that consisted of about 32 pieces of music. It was just a transition that happened naturally. And I think he probably would have agreed to doing that because he didn't like specifics. I think he liked for people to have just enough information to maybe dream up. He wanted to give enough information for people to make up their own minds as to what it was. And in that way, the people would have a part in his compositions.
One more part from your book. There was an unfinished essay that he wrote called The Race for Space. I find what he wrote here so prescient. But he writes, "Jazz is a good barometer of freedom. When pure jazz is not accepted, and pseudo-jazz with political and dogmatic codings take over, you can look for freedom of expression to step out of the picture. In its beginnings, the USA spawned certain ideals of freedom and independence through which eventually jazz was evolved, and the music is so free that many people say it is the only unhampered, unhindered expression of complete freedom yet produced in this country." I love the eloquence that he writes with. I mean, it's amazing, a man who could look so eloquent, who could write music so eloquently, and who could write words so eloquently. There's a lot of truth in what he says, and I find it echoed with what other musicians have told me, and that is that jazz is a democracy.
Like I said, he was not so quick to bind himself to one idea or one set of beliefs. He was open to writing about and exposing himself to and accepting from other people anything that they believed, because that was his education. That was his formal education and how he could find out about people. And especially his orchestra members. And each of his orchestra members were part of his persona. He could be divided into how many ever musicians were on the stage. He would make up things like he would say, I'd like to dedicate this next number to the most beautiful woman in the audience. And we don't want to point her out because we don't want her to be self-conscious about the situation, but we just want her to know that we know that she knows that we know that she knows that we know who she is.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd like to do verbal tricks like that to say what he meant to say, and he couldn't really be pinned down or questioned about it because he would leave it up to the audience to make up their minds what he was saying, to interpret his work.
Can we shift a moment and talk about your life in dance and your life in choreography? I understand that you studied under Jose Limon and also under Martha Graham. And these are two pillars of the history of dance.
Yes.
And I would love to hear what insights you took from these two masters.
First of all, I went to Juilliard. And that's how I came in contact with these two people. But I did not want to go to Juilliard because I wanted to be a dancer. And in those days, and nowadays also, the dancers and athletes have very little time for their careers because of the body and how much you can do in the time that you have before the body starts to break down. So I was in pursuit of work, of working and wanting to audition for shows and things like that. But my grandfather insisted that I go to Juilliard to get formal training because he had sent all of his arrangers to Juilliard. He sent Q, he sent my father, Luther Henderson, Billy Strayhorn went. Then he sent, of course, me, not as a musician, but as a dancer. And I really can value that time now and see how my career has been affected by that and the influence that I had and the people that I had came in contact with, as you say, Jose Limon and Martha Graham. I went in there and I wanted to get a BS, a Bachelor of Science degree, which was a 5-year course, but I wanted to do it in 4 years so that I could get out quicker. So I went to summer school at Temple University in Philadelphia, where my mom and her family were living. And I got the credits so that I could get out in 4 years. So when I first entered Juilliard, they suggested that I take modern, because everybody had to take modern, no matter what your specialty was. They suggested Jose Limon because his works were lyrical and more like ballet. And they knew that I had had some ballet training because I had a scholarship at the Metropolitan Opera School of Ballet that was connected with the Met at that time. And so I took, for the first 2 years, took from Jose Limon. But when I saw Martha Graham's classes, I fell in love with her technique, and I asked if I could switch, and they said, yes, after 2 years of Limon, you could switch. And so I did. So I had 2 years of Limon and 2 years of Martha Graham.
How did these two teachers inform your own choreography later?
Well, I have a lot of moves that are basic because these two modern giants set the bar of most of what I was involved in, which was jazz dance. And of course, my tap experience came later. But I came out of Juilliard with enough of an encyclopedic exposure to all of these techniques that informed my choreographic career as well as my dance career.
I wonder if this leads us to the intersection of music and dance, because coming from such a musical family, you already must have had a solid musical base. I wonder if you saw any overlap there between music and dance. In my experience, dancers often have very progressive ears, and they can often hear music, what some would consider difficult music, they often understand it more easily. And I just wonder if dance informed your musical ear and if music informed your dance.
Well, that was one of the advantages of Juilliard, because while at Juilliard, to get that BS degree, I had to take music classes as well, sight singing, sight reading, and we had to learn to play basic piano. We had to know where the notes were, where the keys were, things like that. So it wasn't totally dance. We had L&M literature and material of music, and Louis Horst was one of the teachers. So we had a pretty good all-round exposure, not only to the dance element, but to the music element. We had dance notation. They tried to give you, and I don't know if that's true today. I don't know what the syllabus is at the present Juilliard, because I believe it's changed a lot. But I had exposure to a lot of music theory and composition, etc. So when I came away, I was able, when talking to a musician about what I was choreographing, I knew how to talk to him in his terms, and we would be able to understand each other.
Was your first professional experience after Juilliard, did that come with the June Taylor dancers?
Well, not immediately. I had a hard time getting to that point, because dancers of color did not have that many opportunities either on Broadway nor in any of the dance companies, except for Alvin Ailey and a couple of other smaller companies. But when it came to the big ballet companies, an exception was Arthur Mitchell, who was in, I think, Balanchine's company. And then you didn't have anybody after that who was able to carry on the ballet tradition. And a ballet tradition, I remember somebody telling me that Balanchine said that people of color, their bodies were not meant for ballet, but they weren't built for ballet. There are things that are not talked about now or have changed. And certainly people of color are now getting more and more accepted in the classical world. But I think things are still, even politically, you can follow the trend of the arts. And the arts should be so separate, or at least the arts should be able to influence the political world, because sometimes you just listen to the political world, they don't know what they're talking about. Now, Ornette Coleman, just down to basics, Ornette Coleman was a musician who had a theory that he demonstrated by having a bowl of water on a table. He said, you put the bowl of water on the table and you have a musician playing in close proximity to that bowl of water, and you'll see the bowl of water move to the sounds of the music. Then you ask the question, what does that do to the liquid in your body? So if you are around those musical waves, what is happening to the water and the liquid in your body? To that end, the Louis Armstrong Music and Medicine Foundation offer musicians who go to hospitals, they compose choirs to sing, and they put that into action. For instance, my mother was a ballroom dancer, and when she became of age, she was in an assisted living place. I was going to visit her one day, and she was doing a tap step called the Shim Sham. I was so surprised. I said, "What? Where did you learn that?" Then she tells me that she was a ballroom dancer, and she belonged to this group called of women called the Noicerelles, and they would, with their partners, go to their parents' dances, and at intermission, they would entertain the parents with their dances. And in that day, you had the Renaissance Ballroom, you had the Savoy Ballroom, the Audubon Ballroom. That was prior to the popular, you know, watching television and staying home and sitting down and getting fat. So she was surprising me, but it was a trend that happened, that there was a close relationship between dancers and musicians. And you can tell about also in an improvisational way when you see improvisational tap dancers who are very much influenced and have a conversation with the musicians, and they are really attached to the same qualifications and the same airwaves as the musicians. So when dancers and musicians are performing together, you can detect the relationship between the two. And that is also one of the reasons why in Sophisticated Ladies, my father ended up with the musicians being on stage. One of the first times that a full orchestra was on stage during a Broadway musical, the singers and the dancers had a close relationship with the musicians because they were right behind them, backing them up.
I want to go back to that baked-in racism from Balanchine.
Oh, yes.
To say something like that out loud, it reminded me of when Jimmy the Greek got fired. You remember in the 80s, he was explaining how African-Americans have a genetic advantage when it comes to athletics.
God.
Right? So it can be used as a pro when it's convenient.
Yes.
And it can be used as a con when it's convenient. And I know, Mercedes, that you were the first woman of color in the June Taylor dances.
Yes.
That was featured on the Jackie Gleason show.
Yeah, that was a trip.
Yeah, tell me about that trip.
Well, I met June Taylor in the beginning because she had a dance school on Broadway and about 55th Street, and there were all kinds of ballet, jazz, and tap teachers teaching in her studio. I started taking lessons in that studio, and that's how I met her in the first place. I knew that she was the choreographer of the Jones Beach Marine Theater productions, which happened at Jones Beach every summer. There was some really extravagant production, like Around the World in 80 Days or something. And it was book material most of the time. And the orchestra was Guy Lombardo. was also the live orchestra that was playing, and he would float his musicians on this, not on the pontoon between the main stage and the fore stage, but in the water in between. That's where they would play from. And then you heard and saw all of these dances, and the action, the singing action was from that place. Now, this was like a prime example of a dancer's career. Not a soloist, but an ensemble dancer. That was the greatest thing that you could have because it lasted all summer, and then you could go and get unemployment. So you were in it for the whole time, and you had an income, an insured income for a long period of time. So every year, everybody would get ready to go to the audition for this event. And there were a lot, I think there were at least be 18 to 20 dancers that were hired. Men and women, because it was a huge cast. That was the first time that I met June Taylor. So I auditioned and I went and I was in at least three of her shows out of Jones Beach. And then a friend of mine called me up one time and said, are you going to audition for the Gleason show that June is going to be doing? And I said, oh, well, I don't think that they hire any people of color. And maybe I'll go just to learn the combination, because this was a thing that happened on Broadway, too. A lot of people of color knew that they weren't going to be hired, but we all went just to learn the combination, and that would be like a free jazz class. Then we'd know we'd, you know, be dismissed, and we'd go out and have coffee afterwards. So I said, well, yeah, then I'll have a chance to see some of my friends. So I got a call from a friend, and she said, I know the combination. Come over to my house. We'll go on the roof and I'll teach you the tap combination, because that was my weak spot, was tap dancing. So she taught me the tap combination, and I was still a little fuzzy about it, but at least I had a kind of a head start. And the Ed Sullivan Theater was where Stephen Colbert, he now has that same stage. So every time I see the Stephen Colbert show on television, I remember that that's where we were dancing. And the audition took place on the top floor of the building. And I remember going through all of the ballet and the jazz and the tap. And it was a long, long day, starting at 10 a.m. with a bunch of people. And she was eliminating as we went along. She would line up after each of the series of combinations. She would line us all up and she would eliminate people. And it got down to a very few in the lineup. And I was standing in the line and I looked up and down and I saw and counted like maybe 17, 18 people. And I just was expecting that I would be the next person to be eliminated. And I was looking towards where I had kept my clothes so I could hot foot it over and make my change and go home. And then there were a couple of other eliminations. And then Gleason walked in the room. Jack Philbin walked in the room. He was the producer. And they were talking amongst themselves. And then they announced, June said, "Ladies, congratulations, you are the next June Taylor dancers." And I thought they were making a mistake. I was getting ready to go to get my things. And June said, "Oh no, you stay. You're going to be one of the dancers." And then she took me aside and she said, "Now there's going to be a big deal about this, but just remember, if you don't live up to the dances, if you make too many mistakes, if you don't keep up your work, I will fire you." Because she used to fire girls every week from the line because of either if they had torn tights, if they didn't behave, if they started arguments. It was really, we were like soldiers. By the time I got dressed and I went to the phone booth outside and called my mom in Philadelphia, she already knew because it had been on the news.
Wow.
It was high pressure. And this was a time, this was the same year that Kennedy was assassinated. And I just, you know, I felt self-conscious about everything.
Did you feel a pressure, an added pressure? Did you feel, "Oh my Lord, I'm representing the black race here on this show"?
Not only that, I felt the pressure because my tap dancing was not that great. And so every day after the rehearsal, I would go and take a tap class. That was the concern. I was just, you know, there was a lot of pressure, but you can't pay attention to that. And that's what I think I got from my grandfather, because he was not really paying attention to that, because what he had to say about it, he did it with his music. And so now I'm in this dance line, and that is proof in itself that what I have to say about it, I'm in the line, you know, and the best that I could do is my version of, well, you know, this is how it should be.
That's right. This is how it should be. And I think it's just a shame that we have to keep saying this is how it should be every 15 years.
Yeah.
These battles that are fought and I thought were won seem to be refought all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, since you brought Duke back into it, let me ask you this. What was it that drove you over 20 years ago to found the Duke Ellington Center for the Arts? What was your goal in founding this institution?
It was a 501c3, which meant the category was educational. It gave me a thought that we could be very creative in setting up events, programs, concerts to demonstrate all of that of the music and to expose people to the music of Ellington through dance and through song, all of the performing arts. We could use that as a venue for lots of dancers. There's always scholarships for younger dancers. And so this could be an opportunity for other people who were not necessarily on scholarship, but they had an opportunity to do their craft in a professional way in front of an audience. I mean, a lot of people, you know, they take classes as a career. There's some people who, if they didn't take classes, they would never dance, especially people of color. There were some people I knew, they used these classes that they took, the jazz classes, the tap classes, as performances for themselves, because there was no opportunity in any place in the professional world for them, neither on Broadway or a professional company But nowadays, you have people of color in the Rockettes. You have, lots of other areas where there never was before.
We're beyond Alvin Ailey and Revelations.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me, Mercedes, and thank you for the work you're doing. I really appreciate you, and I appreciate you taking the time with me today. I'm going to make us both sound normal.
We're exceptional. We're not normal.
Thank you for correcting me on that.
Nobody in this business is normal.
That is so true. In the words of Duke, love you madly, and I hope to see you next time I'm in New York City.
Okay, and I'll add 4 kisses, 1 for each cheek.
You've been listening to Soundboard, a Steinway & Sons podcast on artistry and craftsmanship. Our opening music is Philip Glass's Mad Rush, played on a Steinway Model M by me, Ben Finan. Our closing music is the title track from Money Jungle on Blue Note Records, featuring Duke Ellington, Charlie Mingus, and Max Roach. We heard a bit of Duke and Ella Fitzgerald performing It Don't Mean a Thing If It Ain't Got That Swing on The Ed Sullivan Show. And we heard Duke joined by John Coltrane for In a Sentimental Mood on Verve. Question for the podcast? Email me at info@steinway.com with the subject heading Soundboard. Message me on Facebook at Steinway or hit me on the gram at Steinway & Sons. Subscribe to Soundboard on Spotify, Apple Music, Deezer, or wherever you pod your casts. Thank you for listening.